I have to use some cough drops.
Well, I should be using cough drops, but I'm they're in another office, so I'm. But
Yeah.
I have a scratchy throat. I'm gonna try not to clear it too much.
I think we're both going to do a lot of.
I know I'm gonna try not to do it. I do have a cough button on this mic that I can.
What mute?
Yeah, it's a yeah, but they call it a cough button, like in radio. Hey man, I'm using the parlance.
I'm sorry, I worked in a call center for so long. It was just the mute button. It was also the this fucking guy button.
Oh, there's my phone. It disappeared. Huh, portal. Huh.
So he does have a phone.
Welcome to Know Your Rights, a music podcast from two guys who know just enough about songwriting to start a podcast about.
Follow Rob
and Colton
as each week we dive into a different band or songwriter and discuss what makes them great,
okay, or otherwise.
Music is law,
and we know our rights. And
welcome everybody to episode 87 of Know Your Rights. I am Rob.
I am Colton.
And today we are going to be discussing, what is it, 1971?
1971.
1971's Don McLean's musical composition, American Pie.
We're in this already.
What? What's?
We're what's, so deep in this.
What's the problem?
If you are, okay, there's a lot to get into here. This is my choice.
Yes, great choice.
I learned some things about Don McLean today.
Okay.
That I think are worth talking about that I didn't know. But I want to just like push that off to the side for a second. If you're wondering why my friend, my good friend and co-host starting. Oh, and like the fake thing you're doing right now. Oh.
Oh, you wanted me to use the term song instead?
We've recently say it again. This is episode 87 of this podcast.
Episode 87.
We are 87 episodes in. We are like half a lifetime of friendship and songwriting in to just knowing each other and loving music. Mm-hmm. And I feel like last episode, if you listen to it, it's a good episode, by the way. I just heard it this morning. Mother, Mother, Touch Up. Another classic episode that afterwards I thought, ooh, I don't know. I don't know how that went. And then when you do your Magic Man, it came out great. It came up that my friend Rob had some questions about how to define a song. And
I was unfamiliar, but that's why the face is sincere. I still think it's a musical composition.
I know your BS face. This is your BS face. This is a song. What we are discussing today
absolutely
is a song.
It's a song. It's also music, a musical composition.
Melody, lyrics.
I think a song is a musical composition. Just a musical composition is not always a song.
I'm going to hang up this Zoom session right now. What? Because what's happening
I found
like
a way to meet
grade.
In the middle.
There is no middle. There's
a middle. No. You have not always been there, buddy.
Can I quote what you said right before we started recording? You said, don't worry. I think I found a way to make this work. Those are exactly
I'm doing it right
line.
Now. I'm meeting you in the middle. This is
we are living
work.
In a dangerous time of misinformation. So anyone who's listening to this who is worried, I am the voice of reason to tell you.
He is the English major. Doctor of English.
Yeah, hold on. I'm not a master. I do have a master, but that okay. You're getting me off track.
Yeah,
stop, okay. Stop.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'll let you go.
I don't want to do it.
All right, then I'll continue.
Please. Okay.
All right. So what are our categories every time we do an album?
Oh, this is happening. Okay. What? Best song, worst song, overrated?
What was your underrated? Worst song on Pink Floyd?
Oh, I don't know. What was it?
Do you remember? It was On the Run.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Musical composition. I mean, you've already misused your so precious term for songwriting, but you decided that it was a song then. You chose.
This is,
I'm just saying.
If anyone's listening to this going, what's going on here? It's because Rob was trying to make the argument that Beethoven was a songwriter.
Yes.
And now, what ended up happening after was him going, oh my God, what have I done? I'm going to make this a bit for the rest of this podcast so that Colton has to understand what a song is and Rob has to go,
Yeah. Now, I did get mixed reviews. I did decide to go and poll the people.
What people did you ask?
I won't say any names, but certain musicians felt like they had your mentality. Obviously, a song is this, where I'm like, okay, I did not know that. But other musicians actually were like, oh, I think that's kind of a loose-fitted thing. Like, yes, technically that's right, but it's okay to call that a song. Now, you're absolutely right. I tried my damnedest. Definitely when we got off of that episode.
Yeah, please finish the sentence. Okay,
go ahead. I really tried. I really tried. Where I was like, oh, I'm going to get him on etymology. And I'm like, nope, etymology isn't helping me in the slightest.
No,
like,
it nope. actually is. Like, literally
incantation is like used, or I'm like, oh,
almost
shit.
As if I'm using the exact definition of how we understand those terms. It's crazy.
I'm just saying you haven't used that exact definition throughout the podcast. So you were just further leading me into this moment where you can aha me.
I think what's we've come up against in this, and I'm being serious here, come up in this podcast against albums and artists where I think from my side of things too, they've kind of pushed my understanding of what I think songwriting is. Like, I remember as far back as like talking about Led Zeppelin with you, and I had this whole thing where it's like songs where it's like riff based and like jam based, even, right? Yeah. Like, where does songwriting and jamming and like improvisation, right? Where does that come through? And I'm like a huge jazz fan, and like, I don't think of Miles Davis as a songwriter. He's a composer. Like,
there's one thing he's got to do. Give us one of those right before I change.
But there's you're okay, I am like, this is like another weird Colton thing. I hate vocal jazz, man. I'm not a vocal jazz dude. If I'm listening to 91.1 jazz, if vocal jazz comes, and there's like some cool like throat singing stuff that I'll be into, but like the vocal jazz, like, and like I love Abby Lincoln, but man, it's a hard sell for me for the most part. I gotta go. But I love you, and I'm happy that you're coming to grips with this. I'm happy that you're accepting.
Overall, I've accepted
how wrong you are.
However, I still think my stance on this can still stay to where the importance of music in songwriting can still be still outshine.
No, not outshine.
It can still outshine the lyrics. In fact, plenty of times it has. Limp Bizkit, for example. Plenty of times the music has outshined the lyrics, but it's a song.
You're so up your own ass right now. It's insane. Like, I don't know. Like, listen to yourself. Like, what are you doing?
What are you doing? You gave me an extra 2 days.
And you came in with Limp Bizkit. You're like, and by the way, the band that proves my point, Limp Bizkit.
We have both agreed that West Borland has some good shit. Fucking John Otto took you to the Matthews Bridge and taught you drums there.
I was also 13, so there's
can we agree that the music's better than the lyrics in this instance?
In the Limp Bizkit instance?
I'm saying.
It depends on what song. Are we talking about In Together Now? Are we going Method Man, Fred Durst?
Sure.
Why not bring up hip-hop great Fred Durst? We're going to talk about Rakim.
Rakim has got a new album coming out after 15 years of kind of silence. Mm-hmm. So who knows, maybe Fred Durst is making a guest appearance on there.
I was gonna say someone's getting a boost from that and someone is not. Like, they're meeting each other on different, like on an elevator down, elevator up situation. How are you? How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing okay. Outside of both of us, oddly enough.
Got the scratchies, man.
We both got the scratchy voice.
Got the scratchies. That's all right. You know what? We got some good music. Today is like good music day.
I think so, too.
Today's a good music day. So I'm happy for that.
How was the family? In case anybody doesn't know.
It was very good.
We're back on a Tuesday.
We're back on that Tuesday business. And you know what? I'm pumped for a Tuesday. I'm ready. I had a good Tuesday. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling good. Alive.
Good, good.
It's very good. My nieces are keeping me young-ish. They're going out. You have not met any of my nieces, have you?
I have not. I haven't seen most of your family in a while, ever since the Dodgers game.
I did check with my sister, by the way. She has no memory of us seeing Bad Boys of San Diego.
Right. I have a bad track record. Like I said, I have to work on my reputation here, so I'm going to do my best to be absolutely certain of a memory before I open my mouth.
I know we always do this, but I always feel, I think we both feel bad at a certain point of the podcast. Like we were like mid conversation at a party and someone just introduced themselves. I have to pause and go, hey, new listener, how you doing? We will talk about Don McLean's American Pie.
Yes.
A Marvel film where in order to enjoy one of our episodes, you have to have listened to all 86 episodes.
That's a really good point. I think we do need to start saying that at the beginning of every, like,
previously on. No, you're right.
Yeah.
We may get rid of the songwriter. Beethoven's not a songwriter.
That could probably help us with the outtakes. We just get rid of the outtakes and have previously on. That's not bad.
That's not bad. I'm game for that. So we have our something new segment for every song spotlight episode. Yep. You introduced our something new segment. What did you choose for this week, Rob?
I chose Rockin's A Different Kind.
Wow. And
there were other options, but I just thought this would be kind of a different avenue for us.
No, it's cool. And like as much as I love like East Coast hip hop and things, like mm-hmm. Rakim is not in my wheelhouse. I'll say it that way. Like I'm like aware, but I'm not like deep in the discography of Rakim. Like aware enough of like his place in hip hop, but this was, I saw someone mention this in like a YouTube comment, and it's like Mana in the Desert. Like, how do I not sound like an old man? Like hip hop today, like young hip hop, like the kids in like Generation Z, right? Like the rap that they're exposed to of people of their that like generation, man, it sucks.
I won't say it sucks. I won't say it sucks, but I do miss kind of more of the old traditions, the old values of hip hop.
And I should say, I know that there are artists out there that are doing good work that I obviously am just not aware of, but yeah. I'm talking like very broadly of like kind of like mumblecore.
Yeah.
Like, and I've already made my thoughts clear on someone like Young Thug, where I'm not like a Young Thug hater. He seems like he's living an okay life, aside from I think he got arrested at some point. I hope he's free from that. But
unless he's guilty.
I think it's tax, though. Tax evasion. So.
Oh, well, then fuck it. Yeah. No. I hope you're free, buddy.
By the way, Rob and I both pay our taxes. We're fine.
Colton definitely does.
I don't know. Like, I think at a certain point, I always just assume like for people like hip hop is like the highly lyrical and it's also the production too. Like I just feel like producing in like hip hop tracks became so, there's a minimalism to it that it can work. And like, I partially blame Pharrell for that. I don't know. Like I've always been a sucker, like Kanye West and like, you know, like the old soul samples mixed in or like jazz and hip hop. Like that's the stuff that I like pump it in my veins, like Freestyle Fellowship too, like the horns and everything. I need that stuff.
And so this song, I think, delivers a little, at least a little bit on that.
Oh, it's Mana in the Desert. That's what I was. Yeah. I was getting to that eventually, which was I was building up my old band's team. It's just so refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not a huge Rakim guy. I've listened to The Master. That's really the only album that I've gone beginning to end. But I've always appreciated it anytime it's come on. But yeah, I just saw this and listening to it, I was like, this is hip hop. Like, he didn't try to reinvent himself. He just came going like, I'm just going to come at you with the Rakim. And I think some of his lyrics are really good on this.
Yeah, I want to look up the lyric sheet because I want to get the couple of bars I saw that I wanted to go back and see again. And who knows if they're going to give it to me. Oh, God. Everyone hold your breath. I'm clicking on Genius.
That's where I'm at right now. Who knows how long
it takes. I did not, by the way, click on the Genius page for American Pie. I was like, that will take forever to load. There'll be 10 different ads. I'm not even going to touch it.
Yeah, I noticed that today when I was trying to read the lyrics for American Pie. And all of a sudden a commercial came on. And I'm like, well, this is distracting. And I couldn't even find the damn commercial on the page. I was like, what the hell's going on? I just want to read right now in silence.
It's a mess. This is, I think it's like near like the final verse where he's like,
okay,
glow shade free, my show jalapeno, that's right, don't play then pay me, be my quote, my C notes, that's the do re mi fa sol la ti do.
That's a great line. Great line, man. And that's what I like, and I love the way he plays with it all too, because like you're going off of the last verse.
Yeah.
I think it's only two verses, right? Yeah, it's the two verses.
Mm-hmm.
But in the first verse, I love when he hits the, well, obviously, this is my Hannibal on an elephant entrance. I'm like, all right, that's already just a cool, like, historical reference. And this is where he starts kind of dropping, you know, a lot of, like, historical references and a lot of biblical stuff. But I love when he hits the, this is a parallel universe, then vice versa. Like, the verse and versa.
Yeah.
Together. Like, that's such good wordplay. Oh, give it to him, man.
Yeah. It's, and I think there's a, like, I've always, like, as much as it's like highly lyrical hip hop, it's also hip hop that isn't like when a track is so tied up to a concept,
mm-hmm.
it has to be a very good concept for it to work for me. Like, I'm thinking of the newest I'm Kanye pilled right now. The newest Kendrick Lamar album, right?
Okay.
Where I think it's the final track where he is like rhyming to supposedly his woman, right? His partner, whoever. I mean, he's not like naming who it is, but it's like clearly like a woman he's talking to. And at the very end, he's like, and it was my pen the whole time. Like, it was like his pen that he like writes his rhymes with.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I love Kendrick Lamar. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It's so stupid.
I mean,
and it's like tied to this concept that like, that can be done really clumsily, and it's, I don't know, but when it's like lyrical and it's based in boast and it's like, you know, it's like toasts, right? That's the stuff I think is like tied to what I know of that tradition that I think always works the best.
I think that's the kind of nailing it. This is the original tradition of hip hop. He's boasting, he's bragging about himself over a beat, you know, and he's doing it in a really clever, fun way to where his lyrics are still flowing excellently. That it's what you said, it's the man in the desert, it's the reassurance of like, oh, there's still this is something that I fell in love with, you know. And it, maybe it's missing a bigger picture, which can be pretty cool in hip-hop, but at certain moments I'm like, yeah, just go up there and talk about how fucking dope you are.
I don't need bigger picture stuff all the time. Right?
Not all the time. Yeah.
Because again, that also can go really poorly. Like I'm very iffy on that. Because it's also the tradition. It's the dozens. I don't know. Yeah. Like that's the stuff that you can listen to it for days. You really can. Yeah. I will say, how old is Rakim? Do you know?
Ooh, I know he's up there. Because I mean the master I think was in 93.
Well, and like his kind of big record he did was like in the 80s, like late 80s. So I want to say he's like in his 50s or 60s. Is that accurate?
Let's see. We got him at 58.
58. Okay.
So the fact that he didn't have shitty bars at 58 is a good sign.
I mean, you did not watch the video, I'm guessing.
I did not.
No. Okay. I was going to bring it up because I thought it would be a nice segue into a brief little sports talk, because he is definitely, this was shot after the finals. He is full up in like his Knicks championship gear.
Of course. Which, he's got to have his Knicks regalia for sure.
But it's also, he looks 58. Like, and I only say it because, you know, in The Irishman, Robert De Niro is playing like young guy. But it's like that stupid de-aging thing that they decided to do for that film. And when he's like beating up the guy in front of the restaurant and he starts to move and you're like, oh, don't move, Robert De Niro. You look like an old man. And you're supposed to be in your like, I think 30s or something. And Rakim like mentions like graffiti or something in one of the lines. And then it's like a shot of him like graffitiing on a brick wall. And it's just, it's bad. I'm like, he's like kind of hunched over and he's like,
He's got to lean in to really see the clarity.
Yeah. It's not a good look, I think. But I gotta say, I still like that video. It was all very endearing to me. But it's also just this weird thought I had where hip hop is so new. Like, it's such a nascent like art form, right? When you think about like its origins and like the practitioners and like rappers who, like, how old is the
walking through the woods with machete creating a trail? Yeah.
Like, I gotta say, they're probably the oldest, or maybe 70. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see when this generation of rappers gets to like when Jay-Z is going to be like 70, right? like Drake is like old, like 80s age. Like, it's just exciting to see, like, we don't know how rappers will age, and like to hear Rakim like doing this at 58. I'm like, that's interesting, because like rockers don't age well, like the new Rolling Stones. No, thank you.
Yeah, the new, you're right. Yeah.
The new
you and me. Yeah.
The new Paul McCartney. The new Paul Simon was good, or the most recent Paul Simon. But
that's like geriatrics right there.
He's, I mean, yeah, that's it's it, we don't know what that looks like. And so it's like it's such an unknown. And I'm excited for it. And it's also, I mean, it's like people who talk about millennials who are going to be in retirement centers playing Pokemon.
Blaring Eminem. Yeah.
I will listen to Eminem with you. I'll play Pokemon. If we end up in the same retirement home, we can still record this podcast.
That was always my plan. So hopefully everything goes accordingly. Just one last thing on this. I think the beat is really cool.
Oh,
I love during the verse too, when the drums drop out and they dip back in. I've always loved that in hip hop, where there's when you can have that moment where the cadence kind of carries the rhythm.
I'm such a sucker for horns too in a in a beat. Like such a it's like
in
a
pomposity. Beat.
It's yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I've also heard that you're not a sucker for horns in some other facets of music.
When they're done the way that Streetlight Manifesto does it.
Yes, that's true.
We don't need to feed that episode anymore. That episode has grown. Also, weird shout out, Phoebe Bridgers. What happened? Like, people are all over Phoebe Bridgers right
now.
Oh, yeah.
That
episode.
Cool.
That is,
cool.
I think that is close to our most listened to episode. It's happened in the last like 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then also just the chorus. I love this chorus. I love the scratch. And then you let the little sample fly, scratch, let the sample fly. Like, I love that. Even though I doubt it's a sample of it. I mean, it sounds that way.
It's, yeah. It's, I think refreshing was a good word for this, which like for someone like so deep in their career, it's weird to think of it that way. But you just want that to exist.
Honestly, when I read like New Rock Hymn, it's been 15 years. I was like, it hasn't been longer.
Yeah.
I really would have guessed it had been much longer.
Yeah, like I did not hear the Don McLean's 2024 record, but I was like, I don't think I need to. Like,
no.
Let's not go that route. Oh, man.
Speaking of, I would imagine it's about time to get to talking about some Don McLean, unless you got anything else.
I did want to ask you about the LeBron James move.
Not where I thought he was going to go.
Okay.
Not where I thought he was going to go. I thought, are you okay? I would imagine you're really okay, because I think we were both on the same page. I was really thinking.
I would have gotten Casey on this pod now if he had gone to the Warriors, and because she had already said if he goes to the Warriors, I am no longer a Warriors fan. I will burn my Warriors card.
See, and here's where I feel like I just have to say I was not a Lakers fan. I think I proved it on the podcast plenty. I was not a Lakers fan who hated LeBron. I actually very much so enjoyed having him on. He got us a ring. Don't you dare say anything about that ring.
I'm on the record about the Dodgers in 2020.
There we go. That's true. But yeah, no, it's interesting to see him going to the Sixers and to hear Rich Paul saying he's not ring chasing. Like, he's not. That team is stacked. Now, Embiid has to be able to stand on his knee that's had, what, 3 or 4 surgeries.
I was going to say, I actually don't know if I think going to the Phillies. I think that represents a kind of a Goldilocks zone of challenge.
Going to the Phillies.
It's did I say Phillies?
Yeah, sorry.
because honestly, I don't know. The 76ers are so sad. Like, I think it is a Goldilocks zone of difficulty, because they have pedigree of getting to the playoffs, but they're also, as an organization, like, they're choke artists. Like, it's...
Oh, for sure. So to LeBron's credit, you know what team he was certain he was going to go to?
Was it the Cavs?
No, it was the Knicks.
Oh,
but when the Knicks won the finals, he just went, I can't do that. So there is at least a little bit of, you're right, it's kind of the Goldilocks thing, but it's like, hey, at least you're finding the proper temperature, rather than I'm going to go to the Knicks and help them repeat and pull a Kevin Durant, who I'm sure you and Casey love so much.
Oh, Casey hates Kevin Durant.
Oh, God bless her. I said it before, I love your wife. She's wonderful.
My wife is like dyed in the wool, like pre Steph Curry, like Mo Spates. Like, she has like guys on her Warriors Hall of Fame.
So like Run TMC.
Dark ages. Like,
okay.
Dark ages. But I came after, and I know we're getting Draymond again for another year. So that'll be fun. Him and Steve Kerr can fight more. So
I mean, me and the Snowtime Lakers. So we'll see how this season goes.
So I feel like I brought the sports talk on us, and it just depressed me. So I am ready for that break now, because I want to go cry in the corner, and then we can start our American Bible.
Sounds good. Leo, talk to Colton while he cries. Face blown.
If you're looking for fun events, awesome music, and enjoyable podcasts, then look no further. The Baseblown Entertainment family has you covered. With so many talented people in our community, it was only right that we not only bring you events, but all sorts of awesome entertainment. Follow Baseblown on social media or join our Discord community to stay updated and engaged in everything. That is at Baseblown on social media and discord.gg/baseblown for our Discord. Baseblown Entertainment, bringing you more than just bass in your face.
Welcome to the Siren Songbook, a podcast where we discuss female artists, their music, their history, and the impact they've made on the music industry. Join us each month as we pick a new inspirational artist and celebrate exactly what it is that makes them so magical.
You can listen to new episodes of the Siren Songbook on Spotify every last Wednesday of the month. The Siren Songbook, a Baseblown Entertainment podcast.
And welcome back.
Welcome everyone.
You know, a long, long time ago,
we started this podcast.
When I did that, I was like, what are you doing?
I can still remember how that podcast used to make me smile.
Man, I know that we start these second segments where the person who chose the song talks about the song. I'm trying to remember the first time I heard American Pie. And the thing is, it's one of those songs to me that is, I'm trying to think of those songs we've covered that I think have reached this level. I think maybe Let It Be. The problem with Let It Be, though, is that it's written by the Beatles. And the Beatles are as big as, if not bigger than, the idea of the song Let It Be. But
okay, I had to let you breathe on that one. Like, that's not a problem.
No, but like American Pie is like, it feels like an institution. Like, it feels like a song that is a part of like our cultural fabric, right? Growing up in the US, like, you just, it is there. One of like a rare few of those kinds of heritages that like I like embrace. I'm like, yes. The reason I chose it initially was it felt very on theme of July, yes. Even though this will come out in August, because hi, everyone.
No, you're right. Sweet. But you're hearing us from the past.
Yeah, but I couldn't tell you when I heard it first, because I feel like it's just been there. Like, it's always there.
Absolutely. I don't know whether or not I heard this or the national anthem first.
That's a great way to put it. Like, and when you're young, it feels, I mean, it's the same way I feel about like This Land Is Your Land. Like, they just all become a piece. Like, it's been there from the beginning, like carved in stone.
Yeah, I think I was in my, at least in my late teens, early 20s when I was like, oh, that's Woody Guthrie? Like, I knew who Woody Guthrie was. I knew This Land Is Your Land. But because of who Woody Guthrie is, I would have never guessed this kind of, to me, like a child song.
Right. Or, and like one, like, you know, just passed from generations and generations. I mean, and that's like, this is right in my wheelhouse, man. That's the beauty of folk. That's the beauty of, like,
you're not wrong.
Yeah. It can feel that way, right? Like, this song being so like relatively recent. And also, here's the sick part. How old was Don McLean when he wrote this song? 26.
26. Okay.
I think he was probably closer to 25, 24, 25. Because it's released in 1971. He's 26 when it's released. That's gross.
I know what you mean. Yeah, it's Alex all over again. We're hearing Margaret, and it's like, this kid's 16? What the hell?
And I understand also that, like, that's also, I think, how musicianship and artistry works. Like, we were putting out our best work, well, now, but like, I think that
we'll see. Yeah,
we've maybe felt the most artistically alive. I shouldn't put a we. I'll just put a me here. You might feel differently. I remember my 20s being, I'm still making art, but I was making art and writing songs at a speed that I've not since
yet
have like the endurance for.
And you were doing it in full, like, to where there wasn't, like, I hate to say this about us currently, but there's kind of a scheduled songwriting. There's a scheduled creativity process.
Yeah.
Whereas in our 20s, there was a lot more time to dedicate to it, early teens, early 20s.
Right.
And so that's how this song feels. This song definitely feels like he put his all into this.
And that's like, you know, think of like the 27 Club, like, there's this long tradition, I guess, of like artists hitting a peak in their 20s. Like, it makes sense. But even so, just the scale of it, like, this song feels so like it's ambitious, but it's also weirdly like wise. And I don't know if I necessarily think that now, but it has this idea of like an old man looking back. So the idea that he is 26 with this amount of vision and thought, yeah, that's the thing I think is so interesting and kind of gross.
It is funny you said it too, because like the way the song opens up, you know, with him talking about, you know, being a paper delivery boy. And it's just like in my head, I was like, damn, he's really going far back. And it's like, it turns out he was 13. So he's not even going that far back. But it did initially, I was like, oh, we're getting a Citizen Kane out of this.
You know? I mean, that's what it is. It feels so wide ranging of like, it is the personal, but it's also historical and it's also mythological. Like, this song is known, of course, right, for how long it is, for how referential it is to like music and history, pop culture, all these things. I think on just the level of like scale and ambition, like when I think of like truly great songs and great songwriting, this is, you can ask me on another day, I'll have another answer, but there's a good chance if you ask me on any given day what I think is the best lyrically written song, it'll be this, American Pie.
Okay.
For sheer just amounts of difficulty in what he's doing. And it's also, it's there for a purpose. Like, it's lyrics that build to a purpose, and they also don't reveal everything. And yet they're also, like you just mentioned, like personally revealing.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of everything. It's a kaleidoscope.
It pulls off something that I always wanted to try to pull off in any song I was working on, to where I wanted there to be a societal, like a social commentary. Mm-hmm. I wanted there to be some deep personal meaning for myself, and then just be a great melody, be a great feel good song. And I'm like, this accomplishes all those. But the first two factors of that are really hard to do.
And in a way that doesn't feel eye rolly, right? And kind of cringy. And I mean, I don't know. What are your thoughts on We Didn't Start the Fire? can we
you beat really me to the punch. These two songs have such a similarity to me. But I think there are a lot of songs that function this way. When you said this is the greatest, or on any given day, it could be the best lyrical song for you. Mm-hmm. A small part of me kind of rolled my eyes. And I'm like, this feels like it's a format. Now, not saying that he doesn't effectively utilize it, but We Didn't Start the Fire, there's a default American song where I'm like, I felt like I was just doing the same format, to where it's kind of just like, drop in lines about historical things that have occurred.
But that's just not what he's doing.
I'm oversimplifying him. Like I said, his effectiveness or efficacy, I always mix up those two terms. Which one am I meaning to say right now, doctor?
Tell me the sentence first.
The effectiveness of his lyrics? Efficacy? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're, like, that's where I'm just like, I think like what he was going for is even more accomplished than what I think I or Billy Joel were going for.
And for the record, he makes the template. Billy Joel is 1989, and that song sucks. Yeah. But
I don't think it. That's fair. That's fair. All right, let me scratch that off of our next.
No, I mean, given our bet, you could easily do that. I just remember having to learn We Didn't Start the Fire in AP World History and going, what the hell's happening? Like, why am I having to learn this song?
It's to make sure you understand all the references.
I mean, I could go more, and I will say more, obviously, about why I think lyrically the song is so fantastic. But I do want to, because, like, you know, there's what, four verses, right? So we can attack this verse.
Is it only four?
Like, in between the choruses, I believe so.
God, man. Every time I hear
it. Actually, it could be five.
Because every time I hear the song, I think we're about to hit the soft verse. And I'm just like, nope, well, we're going another. All right, let's pick it back up.
Wait, one second. Four. Oh, we have five. It might be five.
Okay.
Yeah. So if we could do this roughly, verse to verse, right? Because the chorus is the chorus, but I do have to do a quick preface to this, which is like, I didn't realize Don McLean was such a weirdo, and I should put alleged out in front of that.
So, oh, I'm not
sued by the estate of Don McLean, I guess. Dude,
what do they expect from us if they sue us?
Well, you shouldn't. Oh, yeah. Right. Like, all of the know your rights earnings.
But have all our emails.
There's like, you know, wife abuse allegations in court cases. And there's this whole allegation from his wife and his daughter that he's basically trying to run a cult in his household. The cult of the Don. I don't know. I don't think he calls it that.
I never knew that, but it does not surprise me.
It doesn't. Right. Like, if you're... Like, on this same album, the other song of his that I think is so great is Speed Up. And it's my wife's favorite song. One of her favorite songs is Vincent.
Vincent, I prefer Vincent out of these two.
It's a beautiful song. It's also Tupac Shakur's favorite song.
The rhythmic and melodic creativity behind that song, I think, is excellent.
I mean, that's in like 60s, 70s folk songwriting to me. I don't know. That's, to me, it's like... That kind of singer-songwriter ilk today is still trying to reckon with what that all does. But, like, Vincent's beautiful. But when I hear Vincent, I'm like, oh, yeah. There's a little bit of, like, that Van Gogh, like, the tortured, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how much he auctions his ear off for.
Yeah. So that was a bit of a bummer to hear. Mm-hmm. And yet. So I want to talk about the songwriting choices, and I do really love this song. And I think as a songwriter at the time when he's writing it, this is fantastic. Bummer that he's such a wackadoo, probably not nice to folks. I'm being nice
again,
about how I'm phrasing it.
Not a surprise.
I want to just echo a quote I've said on this podcast before. I'm going to paraphrase it from Nick Cave, because it does make me feel better about this, which is Nick Cave in talking about artists being canceled, saying... When you are making art, when you're creating, that's the best part of you. Yeah. And I think it's okay to honor the best part of someone.
Unless you're a good person, in which... like,
yeah,
like
or Colton, just be cool to everyone all the time. Yeah,
like, you're a great artist, Colton, but I'm not going to say that's the best part of you. I also think like how kind a person you are is kind of cool.
I often hinge on not having to worry about how good of a songwriter I am. It makes me feel better. So anywho... Yeah. All of that said, a long, long time ago.
I love how this song starts. And I know that they had like studio sessions where they weren't able to accomplish what they were going for until the piano came in. And then all of a sudden, you know, just all the pieces fell in place. I love how that goes. I love the way the vocal melody and that piano part relate to each other in the intro of this.
Hearing that and trying to imagine this song without piano, like both in the opening and the closing, of course, but also throughout, like there's no way. Like it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I watched a live performance, and I'll get to it later, but the live performance did actually start lulling me. And it was just him acoustic. It was true folk fashion.
Right.
And yeah, at some point I was like, this needs a band. Like, you need to Dylan this the F up.
And because the arrangement of like how they introduce, and like it's in that way kind of a classic, you know, eight minute song where it is all about how do we layer in these different instruments like one at a time. I know we're not to the later verses where other stuff kicks in, but to start from zero like this, but also to end that way, right? Like the book ending. And it's not just that it's so dynamically smart to do it that way. It's the kind of dirge-like, mournful quality of the opening and closing, right?
Nice work with dirge there.
Well, yeah, trust me, I'm going to count down favorite lyrics, like,
okay,
because they're so fucking good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's personable, and it has a very kind of lounge singer-esque to me, like he's kind of leaning on the piano, you know, a long, long time ago.
Absolutely.
I think the rhyme scheme of this song is interesting in that there's a word we've used a couple times here, doggerel, right? Like real kind of basic rhymes. Mm-hmm. I would say especially near the openings in that, the rhymes don't always feel insanely complex and nuanced. But I also, it's one of those things where within the context of what he's doing. So like when I read like February made me shiver with every paper I'd deliver.
AB.
Mm-hmm. And then one of my favorites in that, I'm like, how does he pull that off? like Bad News on the Doorstep. I couldn't take one more step.
That is interesting, because usually it's like, no, you don't rhyme step with step.
And it's also that he's rhyming door with more, right? That's the rhyme. Yeah. The rhyme isn't step and step, right? And that's the thing, is normally when I see Shiver, I'm like, the only reason Shiver exists is because he wants to say deliver. Like, Shiver is manufactured to get to deliver. So
why didn't he say quiver?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not thinking like what other worst words he could use, but it's also the fact that it brings in February. Like, it gives moods, right? Atmosphere to it. Like, I can start to try to pick apart certain words, and yet it's like he's already thought of that and he's done something to the line that makes it make sense.
Well, and it's all within the, I think this is the clearest message. This verse makes the most sense, because the rest of it kind of involves a lot more, you know, like symbolisms and different like ways where it's like, okay, I'm not exactly sure who he's talking about. At this point, like the way the song starts off, everything, even though the rhyme scheme might be a little tried, it's setting up the story so well and setting up the song so well that I hardly take offense to it, because I also think that the vocal melody, his singing approach, he's got a little bit of a hole going on here. Not saying that bad lyrics, but just really good voice.
Yo. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's a beautiful voice. And there's something to be said then about like the cinematic quality of what's happening here. Like you're saying, it's this very kind of wholesome, and yet it's about this really sad, like, childhood memory, right? Yeah. Of basically his hero, Buddy Holly. I mean, this is the 1959 prelude, and it's you almost get a sense of like there's a color going on. It's like February Shiver, so there's this kind of cold bluish white tint to everything.
Yeah,
and it's so slow, and it's also, you can, it's like you can hear, I mean, I guess I want to skip too fast, because I know I want to get to the chorus first.
I know
when it picks up, it's like the camera starts to move, and all of a sudden we're just spanning out and everything is fast. And I think that's one of those things about this song that seeing him, like, I know what you mean, like seeing him play it acoustically is one thing, but this is one of those songs where I usually don't like it when someone says a song, how do I put it? If a song isn't good acoustically and it's meant to be played with that as like a core instrument, I'm always a little skeptical, like, then is it a good song?
Yeah.
And this is one of those arrangements that is kind of spits in the face of that, because I'm like, you kind of need it. Like,
you absolutely need it. Cause I mean, are we ready to go into the chorus?
Oh my God.
Yeah. That drop and don't even know, the piano still comes like it, but when it first just kicks in with the an acoustic guitar starts going, I'm like, ooh, this is just shift. Like, I just got a little bit of a shiver, you know, to where it has a, and then of course the piano accompaniment, like right at the end, right after each line, fucking perfect. Yeah, because, which I got to also say, this will be the day that I die after that first verse, that piano little like thing he does there, so good. It's just,
oh man.
Yeah.
It's the flourishes. It's how, it's how lyrical the piano sounds. And it's also the way that the rhythm of the song switches, right? Where it's this jazzy kind of swing time opening. And now it's like we're getting into like the rock and roll of the 60s. And it's like, don't.
Yeah,
like,
the rock and roll. And
the straighter 4/4.
And very folky. Like George, like, yeah, here's the acoustic. Here's the vocal melody. Here's something to sing along with. It's
And the chorus itself is insanely singable, manages to invoke these bigger ideas. And it's like, for a song that's as big as this, like, what ties it together? And I don't know. I would guess there's a Dylan-esque construction here where there are like 10 other verses in a notebook somewhere. That's my guess. I don't know if that's true. But,
well, somebody bought the manuscript for $1.2 million in 2015. So somebody knows.
What else would I buy for $1.2 million?
Not a manuscript for this song.
Yeah.
not a manuscript, I think, for any song.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there I would, you know what? I'd get a Rob one. Old Lover, New Gun manuscript.
As long as I get the money.
No, but man, it is like, drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. It's one of those lines where it's, of course, it's like the kind of internal rhyming that's happening in it. It's the flow that happens because of that. And it's also invoking these like classic American gestures,
symbolisms,
right?
Yeah.
And it's, and yet it's also about loss. Like, I think, hopefully, I don't know if this is true. It's like, you know how there's like a long tradition of people misunderstanding what they consider to be patriotic songs. It's like Born in the USA and people are like, yeah.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
no, it's
yeah. I
that's
hope
not what that song is about.
It would be a major letdown if somebody, maybe it's already happened, but if a politician used this as their theme song, it's like, no, this isn't really pro America.
Yes,
this is not happy with what happened during the 60s.
Yeah, it's this like mournful quality of like something is lost. And honestly, in the 2020s, I'm like, what a weird parallel. I feel like
sure
of like. How things feel, there's like a loss that has occurred, right? And culture has like gotten away from people. Like, I think this song kind of speaks to that in a way that I still think is really powerful. And I mean, bringing up like the Buddy Holly song, right? This will be the day that I die. It's like, it's very, even there, right? That line you could argue is like, well, that's like a, you could try to poke holes in the simplicity of it, and yet it's referential. And it's telling you this kind of larger piece that like Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, Big Bopper, they kind of haunt this song, like
for
in
sure.
the references and everything.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I hold on again. Cause I mean, that'll be the day that I die is a really fun tune. And the fact that I agree. Like you can make an argument. That's like, oh, that's a little cheeky, but it's like, no, it's good. It's carrying this forward. And my least favorite part of this song is the chorus, but that's, because it does get a little redundant as it's going around. It's like, okay, back to this thing. But also that acoustic performance, watching that audience. Like every time he hit the chorus, he's like, all right, now come together, everybody. And it's just like, you pan into the crowd and it's just all these really dull faces, dull young white Americans. Just,
yeah.
I miss them. It's like, you could tell there's a part of him going like, this is still a rock and roll song. Like, let's get a little bit of the dancing to it. Like, you needed the piano and drums, buddy.
I don't know. I mean, it's tricky. What would I be like? I mean, I wouldn't be at a Don McLean show today. I don't know what I would do. I'd look around and go, I shouldn't be here.
You're still young enough that you shouldn't be there, Colton.
I think that first chord, I think what's smart about it is that they pick their spots with how many times the chorus happens and how many different iterations of the chorus they give us. Like that's in the recording part, at least, right? That's the saving grace. But my favorite verse is the second verse.
Like, okay.
It, just in terms of like lines where I'm like, oh man, like that is freaking good. It's where the song picks up. And man, I'll say piano, I think, is number one MVP. The drums are.
Oh, the drums are perfect.
They're great. Like, yeah. I love how fast they, it's Dashboard-esque to me of like chops.
Okay. See, and I never really viewed it as that. I just viewed it as like such a quintessential, again, carrying the song forward. This is where we're hitting the rock. Like, I feel like we had the, like you said, kind of like the lounge singer opening. Then we get a little bit of a folky, you know, chorus. Here's where it's like, now let's rock and roll. Like, to kind of pay homage. Again, the music is paying homage to like kings of rock and roll.
But it's, I think the thing about the drums is they manage to be as lyrical as the piano. Like there's fills everywhere. Like more fills than I think a normal drummer around the times that he's referencing would ever put in. It's Keith Moon levels of fills. And it's, but it's done in a way that is like, again, when you have a song with such a kind of static like bass to it, it's left to like the piano and the drums really. And the instruments are all trying to add their flourishes to help give it that sense of urgency. But it's just when we're starting to pick up that steam, the trains are going, and it's first like, did you write the Book of Love? And I'm like, yes, man, I'm in. Like that opening verse is so freaking good. It's a callback of like religion, like the sanctity of the 50s. And then this, my favorite line in this song is, do you believe in rock and roll? Like that to me is like in my heart, like tattoo it on my chest. It's beautiful because
that would be a cool tattoo.
But it is, it's such a like poignant idea of like rock and roll as a thought, as an idea, right? As a like, and he's just like paralleled it to religion, and it's like,
and that will be a continued theme throughout the remainder of the song. Not a theme. Theme's not the right term, but something that we'll go back to with comparing rock and religion.
Oh, yeah. And in a way that is, it's a view of religion, I should say, that is tapping into what should be the beauty of it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like the same with rock and roll, that it's seen as this beautiful thing. And it's, I don't know, like when I hear that, it just taps into how I think of rock and roll, just as an idea. Like there's nothing about that to me that's cheese. It's all just like poignancy and just really beautiful. And like right after, can music save your mortal soul? Like I think like those lines and that verse is setting a lot of things up, like you just mentioned. And it's also, I think, another kind of personal revealing thing. I don't know, like, this is where I'm saying the song is walking this such a crazy tightrope of how do we explain the 1960s to people who weren't there? Like, how do you explain what it was like to come out of that decade where, like, when I teach any lit class that gets around the 60s, I always have to explain to my students, here's all the crazy stuff that happened in the 60s, in the
major cultural shifts.
Like 10 years. Like, these are all the things that changed the entire way that we think about United States and culture and race, mm-hmm. and the moon, like just
sure,
for the
sure.
president, like the president's dead, and we got people like
the youth.
I mean, and go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
60s is choking us up, man. But no, I mean, that's the thing, is to take that on, to take that decade on, and then to also make it this like soul saving personal excavation. That's the stuff that's crazy to me. Like,
and that's what I think this verse kind of does, because after you get past the mortal soul, and like, I love the teach me how to dance real slow, mm-hmm. Based off of what I read, it's a little bit of the Colton Robb paradox, where it's, you know, you're more into the lyrics, I'm more into the dance, if you will. So it's kind of like this, like him kind of balancing those two things, not necessarily entirely from him, but it does feel like most of this verse is based off of that, because I've always been trying to break down, who is she in love with? You know? Because I know that you're in love with him, because I saw you dancing in the gym.
I'm sorry. I can just, when you start, yes. I'll just keep going.
And the vocal melody right there is perfect.
And it's, I'll take those rhythm and blues.
I was going to say, you go for the woo if you want. I'm not, I'm a little tired, but.
It's funny that we've gotten this far, and I feel like here's where we can kind of discuss this part of it. Like, this is a song where it invites you to dissect line to line, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're saying it's like, who's the her? Who's the him? Yeah. And I, like, it has that puzzle box quality, right?
Sure.
Like, who's the jester, right? Who's the quartet?
And absolutely. That's what I was trying to apply to it. Yeah. And it seems like it seems like it's really him, just like, you know, he didn't get to go to prom with this chick.
I don't even know if there is a person. I don't know if there's a reference to an actual woman. Like, there is a way of doing that. And yet I also think there is a, like, top down how to write through these like various experiences to get the captured feeling of what, like, that wholesome quality. It's that juxtaposition of the 50s and the 60s, right? And how do you think of the music between those two? And that's like squarely, like, you know, gym, like high school dances.
That's what I mean, like the prom aspect. Right, right, right. I didn't mean there's a specific woman, but
there's a Susie McClain.
Yeah, it just kind of feels like it's that vibe. To where originally I was thinking like maybe he was talking to somebody, or he's like, no, I know you love this music as much as I do because you were dancing to it. Mm-hmm. And then the more I kind of look at it, it's like, okay, I guess it could just be kind of a prom scene to kind of express the still being youthful and sharing music, you know, this way.
And then it pivots to another, like, awesome killer line, right? Lonely teenage bronken buck with a pink carnation in a pickup truck.
I just learned this term because I use spoonerisms as well. To where, like, he mixes, like, to where when it's like, no, it's a bucking bronco. But he just does it to where it's like, no, this will be more effective. Everybody will know what it means. And it impacts the rhyming scheme the proper way to carry the song forward. And I didn't realize I use spoonerisms all the time. I can't reference one off the top of my head, which doesn't make it sound like all the time, but I just ran into that term because that part was always driving me crazy. But it's important because A Pink Carnation in a Pickup Truck is another classic rock song reference.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those, the appreciation at the surface level of like the like aesthetic quality of how things sound, like that verse especially. And then it's the secondary layer of what he's doing to it. But it feels effortless in that it doesn't feel like he's trying to squeeze these references in. Like, do you, in like the newspaper comic scene, there's Pearls Before Swine. Have you read any Pearls Before Swine?
Yes, I have, but I'm trying because I definitely know the funnies.
The goat,
yeah.
And the,
yeah. Yes.
There's like a series of that on Sunday issues where it's the comic, like the artist, he tries to squeeze in as many different references to a given thing as possible. So like this last one for the 250th birthday US, he tried to squeeze as many presidents' names as he could into a single conversation between two of the characters.
And I'm assuming it's only like four frames.
It's yeah. And so it's like, it's crazy. He gets like 30 something. It's amazing. And it's so, you know, it's all the effort of having to squeeze that in. And this is the complete opposite, right? It is effortless. We're like that Pink Carnation in a Pickup Truck is also just a beautiful image. Like, it's like a, and this first verse, I guess the second verse feels like the true verse. Like, this is where I'm like, this is the song. This is like that piano going in, man. Mm-hmm. Like you said, oh, it's so good.
Because that's a, like, I know that to everybody, the choruses may all seem the same, but you nailed it earlier to where it's like, no, there's like different versions of each chorus. Because like, this is the rocking chorus. Like, that piano just brings us right in perfectly. And now we got that really good harmony and like kind of multiple voice section going in with it, and it just carries a chorus perfectly to our third verse.
And this is where too this will be the day that I die.
Stop. Yeah, that little pause. Yeah, yeah.
That little open hat, like, man, that's, I don't know. That, again, it's like those little things. It's like the little decisions that could feel superfluous, like feel unnecessary, and then it's like, no, like, try the song without that. Like, if we're gonna cover that song, if I don't do that, it's like with The Crowing, if I don't do the change up of the drum beat second verse, everyone on stage looks at me and I go, oh no, I messed up.
Has that happened?
That literally did happen. And literally everyone on stage looked at me like, what are you doing? And I went, we were
just following the crowd stare. We had to we were just kind of getting out of the way of the crowd staring directly at you.
Oh man. So this third verse, if I'm ranking verses, I could wait.
Sure.
I'll wait.
No, let's
but
do
this,
it.
This feels near.
I say we do it as we go.
Somewhat near the bottom. And it's still like an awesome verse. But this one feels the most bogged down in references. And yet it's also, it's mythological and right, and like how he's like gesturing all these different figures.
Sure. Well, I mean, I love the way he says like, and moss grows fat on a roll. The way he says fat right there, I'm just like, that's how you deliver a song like this.
I do love the fact though that he chose this song to be like, I just want to throw as much shade as I can at Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. Like, I don't like Mick Jagger.
I don't dislike Mick Jagger. I have to like him a little bit because people have said before to me that I look very Mick Jagger-esque.
To be clear, I was speaking as Don McLean about Mick Jagger. I personally have no feelings about Mick Jagger.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah, I want to clarify.
But yeah, it does seem like he really holds a... we'll get there. There's a certain event.
Why hire the Hell's Angels, right?
Yeah, why the fuck are you high? Like, you could have stopped this, man. Meredith didn't have to die.
I just for the record, though, have you seen Mick Jagger? Like, what is he going to do with the Hell's Angels?
Hey, motherfuckers.
He's going to jump into the crowd. I'm Mick Jagger. Also, that's not how he talks. I'm Mick Jagger.
That was closer. That was a lot better.
Is that our new character, Mick Jagger?
Oh, dude. It's been a while. We'll have to ask Lucky when the next time we see him.
Next time. I hear he's on vacation.
He's on vacation.
But there is a certain kind of like the folksy quality of like the jester, right? And it is a perfect, I mean, obviously that's Dylan, right? The quartet is some band from England. Who knows?
Some band.
Some dudes.
I don't think it's the Rolling Stones.
No. Oh, well. Audience, can you say, okay, like it's like, hey guys, who is it?
Email us at no.your.writs.podcast@gmail.com.
I do love, and this is like the stupid thing, right? Where it's like the jester sang for the king and queen. And it's like, so that's Bob Dylan singing for Elvis Presley, right? And, but everyone's like, who's the queen?
I've read Joan Baez and I'm like, I don't think that works.
No, because she would be more, I mean, her and Bob Dylan are kind of contemporaries.
They're literally dated.
Yeah, like they're, in it. So, yeah, who knows the queen? It could just be, how do you get to James Dean from that? I don't know.
That's a very good point. I mean, just performing for the rich and powerful. Let's go there.
Yeah, but it is Elvis, I think, at a certain level. And that's the thing. I resist it because I could get into this, like, who's who, right? Mm-hmm. But at a certain level, it's like it takes away from the enjoyment of the song. If I'm thinking about is Bob Dylan and the Beatles and Elvis Presley, like, I think you can strip some of the beauty from this song if you're trying to footnote it to death, I think.
I do see what you mean, but it's also kind of part of the beauty of this song in legacy.
It's the choose your own adventure, right? Like that you can, and that you are able to in a way that can be its own like project and like compelling experience. That's awesome.
The whole Rosetta Stone of it all, trying to decrypt or whatever is going on here.
Right. But this is why I think this verse is my least favorite of the verses, is where this one feels the most like, I don't think the lines have any kind of stirring beauty in them. Otherwise it's the most reliant on those references. As opposed to, you know, even like the verse we just talked about, right? There's no pink carnation in a pickup truck. It's enough on its own. So when I'm like thinking about like, the jester and his thorny crown, like even when I was little, I remember thinking, what are you talking about?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's how I feel about the song throughout most of it. In fact, we're starting to get into that to where this just feels like the rest of the song for a lot of it. This is where we're still going after the chorus. Oh, we're still going after the chorus. Or I'm like, how much do we have to cover, you know, vague historical references? But it gets a little tougher for me here. Not that the song loses a whole lot of its flair, because he still also has singing styles to how he sings each lyric that I appreciate very much.
For sure. And even with all we've said just then, I think the Lennon read a book on Marx, that little stanza, is beauty. Like that's so good, because it's like the quartet practiced in the park, right? And it's like the Beatles.
There's also a Lennon in that,
right? Of course, right? It's Lennon. Mm-hmm. But then, man, and we sang dirges in the dark. Come on, like that's
it's very, very cool.
And it's one of those things where it's, people think of songwriting, like lyric mastery, sometimes is like, oh, like the perfect punchline, right? And I'm like, if you're thinking in punchlines with like this kind of songwriting, you're never going to get it. Punchlines feel so tempting, but they kind of cheapen songs too. Like they can easily cheapen because they age poorly. They start to strip away from like the experience of like just the audio beauty, like of how things sound, I think. So when there's a line just tucked in this song, like we sang dirges in the dark, it's like this beautiful, soft image. It sounds beautiful. I don't know, man. Like this is the stuff where I'm just like, ugh.
Well, I think it's wonderful. And then, of course, the lyric that feeds us back into the chorus. So, I mean, it's wonderfully put together at this point, except, like you said, that was kind of a lyric that saved a more dull verse in this song.
It's, to me, the lowest it gets of like the balance that it's trying to strike. But this next chorus, I believe, if I'm right, this is the guitar chorus. This is where the lead kicks in.
I think so.
Because like it's as we go into the helter skelter summer, the guitar is kind of picking up. And now we have that kind of cool slide, right? The guitar is like sliding up the neck. this is like that. No one chorus is the same. It's always a little bit different.
Yeah.
And what they do it.
An evolution to the musical composition.
This is.
Hey, baby.
It is composed beautifully. I hope you've been noticing that as I've been talking about this song, I've made note of the audio beauty of this song as much as the lyrical.
Yes.
There you go, buddy. That's for
you. Yeah, I get it. You're acknowledging a song is a musical composition, but not all musical compositions are songs.
I can't flip this table over. This table is far too heavy.
Makes me so happy. I love seeing you try.
Yeah, so this is the... It's funny because this is like the shortest verse.
What the hell is he talking about?
Which part?
I'm going like, what sports game are we in? No, don't get me wrong. I've done enough research, but like listening to it initially for this verse, I'm just like, is there like a classic sporting event that he's talking about?
Halftime air with Sweet Perfume. That's what you're getting at, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
The field, the players Sergeant take Pepper's, the field. Yeah,
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Band, right? That's
that definitely feels like
thing. And I think it's, I don't know. There's probably someone who said something like that. I think part of it too is this ever expanding look at the '60s, and so maybe it's like the half. Because when was Lonely Hearts or Sergeant Pepper's released?
I believe that's '67. Okay. I could be wrong. You have the computer next to you if you wanted to check that. But while you do check that, I have also heard that, you know, the marching band Refuse to Yield is a reference to like law enforcement, to U.S. Army in certain particular scenarios. We could talk about civil rights. We could talk about Vietnam, you know, to where it can play in those characteristics. But then at that point, I'm going like, I think we need to find a different term other than marching band, because I'm thinking Sergeant Pepper's and I don't want the Beatles to be viewed as the bad guys here.
I don't think they're meant to be. I mean, this is also kind of like the competing of like who owns the '60s, right? So you have the Players tried for a forward pass. There's the Beatles trying to release Sergeant Pepper's. You have the Jester on the sidelines and a cast, because that's when Bob Dylan got his motorcycle.
Yep.
Right. I mean, before accident. That, we're talking.
Neither one of us completed the statement. Yeah. Motorcycle.
He bought a motorcycle. Are we talking to other people? I guess we are. Before that, there's the Birds, right? With Eight Miles High. Like. Mm-hmm. So he's naming off like it. You know what this is also very much like is a oh my god, what's the name of that band? Paper Cut Chronicles. Help me out here.
Gym Class Heroes.
What is the Gym Class Heroes song where he names every emo band that they toured with on?
Oh god.
Death cab for cutie.
Yeah, I took you for a ride in my death cab. Yeah.
That's the worst one, by the way. That reference, because I'm like, he knows he can't make that one make sense. Remember when we all made Gym Class Heroes famous? Good job, everybody.
I still like some stuff off of that record.
I don't dislike, but so that they it's
was
very
it 1967
much
by the way. I just want to check.
Right.
All right, hey, cool.
Hey man, you got it. Marching Band Refused to Yield. Yeah, it's this one, and yet this one to me is not like as weird. It's also like such a weird verse to stick in between.
It's so perfect that it finishes with a like, do you recall what was revealed the day? And I'm like, no. Like I said, no, I guess I don't, man. That's
Don, what are you talking about? Take it in like a global sense, like these stacked verses here of like when we're in like the throw of the scene, it's like a Game of Thrones look at like 1960s rock and roll of like the ins and outs and that. This is where the song is threading, like we've been saying, like all the kind of how do we take the entirety of this culture of this decade and make it make sense. And so it's all these really small, quick, nimble things. Mm-hmm. I think these verses feel better when they're stacked on top of each other versus
certainly
what they're doing. And but I do. I know it's I'm very thrown, because partly I'm like, I'm not as into the Jester Players Birds like drama that's happening here. It's interesting in like a like music shop talk about the 60s sense, but it's not like giving full, I think, respect to like the musicality of what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also this next verse is third favorite. I'll give the official ranking at the end of this song.
Yeah,
but this next verse is freaking good.
I agree with that.
When you started Jack Be Nimble, Jack Be Quick, I'm like, ooh, you're setting yourself up. He lands that plane.
Yes, he does. And it's perfect, too, because he's trying to do kind of the, well, obviously, it's another Rolling Stones. Take that, Jagger.
Should we tell, like, I don't know, our demographic of our
they might not know much about Altamont.
Okay. What I know is everyone who is younger than us, there was a channel called VH1, and they had this amazing series, 100 Most Shocking Moments in Rock and Roll.
Uh-huh.
And it was fantastic. And if
I love that you're using
that,
VH1 as the medium.
That's how I learned a lot of this stuff. Most of my knowledge of rock and roll history is because of 100 Greatest Hard Rock Bands.
Okay.
And 100 Most Shocking Moments in Rock and Roll.
I thought you were going to say pop-up video.
Oh, this is way before that. By the way, number one, John Lennon being shot.
Of course.
Yeah. But so
that's
Rolling
the day
Stones,
the music
or,
died.
Where was it? Where was the concert?
I believe Altamont is the name of the location.
Is that in California, though?
Yeah, I believe it's California. It's basically they were trying to recreate the magic of Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a very bad job of it.
And they hired the Hells Angels, which was a and is currently still a pretty violent
motorcycle club.
Yeah,
yeah. Gang, yes. I don't know. I sound like I'm their lawyer.
Someone's played at Mongrel's bars too many times. Yeah.
I know not to use that word around certain people.
Mongrel's is another motorcycle club in Lancaster.
And they killed Meredith. Oh, I can't remember his name. Well, I remember his first name. That was the beauty of editing right here.
Meredith Hunter.
Hunter. So allegedly also pulled out a. There's two sides to this, but there's just introducing way too much violence to a peaceful. Attempt at a recreation of Woodstock, which is viewed as like the festival of the 60s.
And it won't be the last time that people try to recreate Woodstock, which I think is.
Are we talking Fred Durst again?
And it's always worked out. Every time we've just nailed it, everybody.
Yeah.
This is another one of those kind of catastrophic, like the loss of innocence. So it makes sense. Again, this is like where like that emotional peak. Mm-hmm. Of this part of the song and like this kind of cultural excavation of what's going on. Like, I think it's how pissed he is at Mick Jagger makes this verse so great. Because it's.
I think there's still forms of conjecture to that. I understand there's sympathy for the devil and definitely talking about that particular event. But I mean, the ending line, I saw Satan laughing with delight. If Jagger's still Satan in this scenario, I don't think. Jagger was super stoked about the turn of events.
I wouldn't say it was that, although I think it's alluded that could be that for sure. Like it could be. But it is also, in a way, I could see it as like evil has won. Like there's some feeling of like
that's
loss,
that's right? What I get from it.
Yeah. And it's all very much reliant on like the religion stuff that he set up before this.
Exactly.
Right? Of like how holy and sacred rock and roll can feel to like what it's like now and what's happened to it. Like it's also so reliant on people having this intimate emotional relationship with music to feel this way. And yet it's, you know, me, young pup Colton watching VH1 about the Altamont like thing going,
for sure. There's a reason we do this podcast.
Yeah.
And this song is touching upon a lot of those elements. Sorry.
And yet we'll never have the idea, the feeling of like, I mean, consider all the traumatic things that we have lived through,
sure.
Right? To where we could try to explain to people who weren't alive when this stuff was happening, what it was like, right? When Dimebag Daryl was shot on stage.
It was when we were talking about, you know, My Chemical Romance.
Why did I bring up Dimebag Daryl, by the way? I'm sorry. But he was shot on stage. That was crazy.
That was an extreme event. That was just like, whoa, like Dimebag Daryl just got assassinated? I'm not even going to go with that one. But like My Chemical Romance with like not realizing how much 9/11 played a big role in his. He wrote so vaguely about it in the long haul. It's like, oh shit, he's actually trying to reflect on this.
Oh yeah. And that's the stuff that that's what music and art can and should do, right? Mm-hmm. Is it encapsulates in a ball what that is like, to where people can go back and be like, wow, this is this huge cataclysmic thing. Whereas like I grew up with like the death of Buddy Holly and the Rolling Stones Hell's Angels thing as like these set in stone, static, concrete things. And yet they are these lived things that were earth shattering to people, like not even involved directly. And yet earth shattering, because it represents this, like I said, this cataclysmic break. And that's the stuff that like I teach, like modernism. I try to like get across how fragmented the world feels after World War One. And you just never appreciate it. You could never appreciate like how big these things feel. And yet you and I, old dog Rob, like this is the stuff that we've had to go through. And I want to hint at this now because it's a question I want to ask you when we're finished. I know we're getting near the end anyway, but this doesn't happen anymore. Like this kind of songwriting, like this attempt at what he is doing, I don't think there's anyone who tries to do this anymore.
I guess in the way that he's doing, I can get behind this because, I mean, like the real historical parallel that I know we both grew up in, but I don't think we can completely immerse ourselves in the culture. But when I think of, you know, Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper and Richie Valens going down in this plane crash, some that I think has the exact same significance is like Tupac and Biggie.
You know
what I mean? To where like I've heard, you know, like Mos Def has a song on talking about this, you know. It's not exactly a decade later, but almost a decade later. So it's like there's definitely like history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
I think that the hip hop is where you would find someone who's capable of doing this. And I guess by this, to clarify too, it's not even just like the loss of these figures and songs about that loss. It's the attempt to configure this huge historical, like, you know,
how
like
big, treatise. How, yeah, exactly.
Opus, you know what I mean? On what it means.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, I feel like music today is so caught in the moment of things and wanting to capture moments that we've like lost a sense of history. Does that make sense? Like,
absolutely. I try not to be too, I'll do my turn of old man yelling at the clouds. Yeah. But when I have, you know, younger people who don't know who, you know, who don't know who Zeppelin are. Let's just use that as an example. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, that's like before my time. And I'm like, it's before my time. Like, you don't have any interest in, I'm not just history in general, even though that part is true as well. The history of music, like, I'm just going to like, you get so many things that lead you to know why this is such good music that you're listening to today.
And then for that interest to go, to evolve into like your art, to where your art is trying to capture that reflect, like this is so reflective, but it's reflective in a way that's not based only in him, right? And that's the that's the marvel of this, is that he's 25 probably when he's writing this, and he's in that state. I love, so I feel like I can reveal to you the ranking now. Verse 2, number 1.
Okay.
Verse 5, number 2.
Okay.
Verse 4, number 3, then verse 2, then verse, or no, then verse 3, then verse 2. Oh my God, then verse 3, verse 4. What's happening?
I think this is a further one. Reason why only one of us is giving our verse ratings.
No. I want to try this again. Cut that one. That was bad. Okay. That's fine. So I feel like I could do this now. So number 1 is verse 2. Number 2, second best, is verse 5. Then verse 4, then verse 1, then verse 3.
Okay.
Those are my rankings, because 5 is gorgeous. Like, very, and the difference between verse 1 and verse 3 is wide, if that makes sense.
It does. I hope everybody followed that.
I know they did. Everyone's got their little diagrams.
Absolutely. Yes. So this is the bridge then? I met a girl who sang the blues?
I wouldn't call it that. I don't think there is a bridge.
That's what I'm saying. This has it listed as bridge.
This is just the final. Like, who calls it the bridge?
Genius.
They're dumb.
That's right. They're definitely not genius.
They're big dum-dums. That's
big
not
dum-dums. Give me gum-gum.
Not a single We're part back. Of that lives in... Oh, man. This one, like the met a girl who sang the blues. Mm. And then it's... It's such a cool little neat tribute, right? To, and again, it's like there's the idea of Janis Joplin, and then there's like, you don't have to know who she is to know there's like this like flash in the pan, like you meet her and then she's gone and she just kind of like goes away. I don't know. It's such a beautiful idea to represent loss.
And there, and this, the somberness of this moment, like we've just been rocking out for how 20 verses, you know, and then finally we're hitting this little like calm. Probably my favorite lyrical spot is, and it's not the most exceptional, but I just love the, and the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. They caught the last train for the coast. Again, I love his
inflection. The coast.
The coast. You know, like it's just like fucking perfect. And it's, it feels like we're coming right back to the top of the song.
And the Jedi I admire.
Yeah, of course, dude.
Ran off with Darth Maul. Now he's a ghost.
I figured we were going to wait. On bringing up Weird Al on this.
I love that. That's his best song.
It's his best parody. And actually, it is pure songwriting.
It's pure. So it's amazing songwriting.
Yeah, because it's not musical composition at this point. The music's been composed. So he's just recreating.
I want you to stop.
He is just what you're doing writing
to try
lyrics.
To normalize this madness that you've been, like, I haven't caught it this whole episode. You need to stop.
I will never stop.
This, like, I'm seeing little kid Rob, your little mischievous grin. I feel like I'm like, I gotta.
That's why I do this podcast. I just want to feel like a kid again. Tomorrow, back to being an adult.
Man,
I was saying,
that is a beautiful verse,
and it feels like, and it's such a good turning point. It encompasses the things that I've noticed the most as thematic throughout this song, is music references, religious references that probably pass as music references, and for this to be the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, it feels a whole hell of a lot like he's talking about Buddy Holly, Big Bopper, and Richie Valens.
It's for sure he is, yeah, and it's that I. It's almost like they escaped before this happened, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to they, like, the death is what caused it. Like, and it's so, like, tricky to even try to add them together. But it is, like, the whole idea of it being the day the music died. Like, I know that's, like, a con. Mm-hmm. It's not like he invented that terminology necessarily, but
I have heard that this song is why they call that day the day the music died.
I always wondered if it was the other side, like, if people referenced it that way anyway. Like, I know we keep mentioning it, and you had a great example with, like, Tupac and Biggie. Like, what I'm trying to think of, like, another more recent example of, like, so many big, like, pop cultural and, like, musical artists. But not even just one guy, like, three people at once. Like, that's the thing. It's like, where I can imagine how it's, like, these three huge figures, right, or, like, emergent figures, at least one of them, Richie Valens, like, just... all in one go. Like, that's the stuff that you can imagine it.
They were huge. I mean, from talking to people much older than us when they were at that time frame, they were like, it was humongous news.
Yeah. So here's where I have to flash a little. You probably know this too. I mean, this isn't like deep musical knowledge. This is just, do I have Wikipedia? Do I have the internet?
Okay.
Who do you know that was in that final? And, like, it's a beautiful way to end this song. That final choral, like, group yell, right? Like, the kind of huge chorus. It's known as the West 44th Street Rhythm and Noise Choir. That's what they're credited as. Do you know who is in that choir? Like, there's no actual proof, right? It's only what people, like, think have guessed at and tried to figure out.
Okay, so this song was recorded, I'm gonna guess, in 70-71.
71.
Were they popular at the time?
Two that I'm seeing, yes. I mean, there's like, I should put it this way. The producer has claimed the choir included. So he's not even naming all of them, but the producer of the song has claimed these people were part of that choir.
Given that I don't know, my guess would be maybe Beatles.
Not the Beatles. One of those guys has actually been, like, who played banjo on Old Man?
Oh God, we talked about this before too. I don't remember, but James, I did Taylor. Remember that. James Taylor. Okay.
Yeah. Apparently he was there, which makes, it's funny to me because I'm like, was James Taylor just what was he doing in the 70s? Was he just hanging around?
Seems like he's just like, hey, let me get in on this.
Hey, James Taylor's outside the studio. Should we shoo him away? Nah, bring him in. He's here.
He's going to get in anyway.
can I play banjo on your song? James, come on.
Yeah.
I've seen fire. Who is it? Carly Simon.
Okay. I wouldn't have guessed any of these.
Yeah. Apparently James Taylor's wife and Pete Seeger, which that one I think is beautiful. Okay.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
he's a real one. Pete Seeger is.
There's a folk legend for sure.
And the fact that I hope it's true that he was in that, because that is like a, that also adds just deeper meaning, I think, to that final chorus. Because that's, yeah. you know, it's like amazing kind of full circle, of like what that song is trying to capture.
Man.
Man, I feel exhausted. That was a lot.
As we were getting talking, maybe I think the second verse, I was like, oh, we're going to be here for a minute.
Well, I'm impressed with this. I don't know. This is
a long song
to do on this podcast. But like, hey, man, we're awesome. But we did it.
We'll see.
We earned ourselves a break. Do you have anything else to add on this side of the break?
On this side of the break? No.
We are going to rate this out of 100. We are going to hear what our next song spotlight is.
That's right. We are.
Oh, and he has it, everybody.
I'm so certain. I've been dropping hints this whole time.
I bet you have. Okay. Leo, take it away.
DJ Brood is happy to bring you a proper session of music listening at the beginning of every week on Twitch. With rotating themes showcasing new music, hits of the past, and specific genres, there is most definitely something for everyone to enjoy. Tune in every Monday from 5 to 8 p.m. Pacific Time as he broadcasts nothing but musical goodness live from the comfort of his home to the comfort of yours. Bedroom Radio, where there are no Monday blues, just Monday vibes. What happens when you get a bunch of obsessive music lovers sitting around a table and talking about every aspect in music? You get the Untitled Mixtape. Join Dango, Lewis, and Lorenzo in this educational but enjoyable podcast that encourages everyone to branch out and expand what they listen to. From deep dives to letting you know what is a bop or flop, the Untitled Mixtape boys are sure to take care of your music needs every Wednesday on your favorite podcast platform. The Untitled Mixtape, a Bassblown Entertainment podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Here we are, third segment. Favorite segment.
Favorite segment.
Except for this time around.
This is, I could rank our segments in general. Favorite, 3-2-1.
I would be different. I would be 3-1-2.
I would probably be 2-3-1, but that's, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it depends on the episode, that's for sure.
It does depend on the episode. So we are going to rank this song, American Pie by Don McLean. Super crazy, weird Don McLean. And probably pretty violent Don McLean. Out of 100.
And yes, out of 100, Colton's decision, not mine. You guys can go back and see if I'm telling the truth or not. Go back and listen to every episode.
Don't throw misinformation in this podcast. We are.
I gave him the opportunity to determine the information. Discover it for yourself.
Oh, do your own research is what you're saying.
Your own research. That's right.
I don't know why I'm dissuading people from listening to our podcast. No, please do listen to the other episodes.
It's only
87
episodes.
Most of them are pretty good.
At least 5%.
So I think it is probably tradition that the person who chose the song goes last.
Yeah, you've tried to make that a tradition.
We can go back to the tape to also see if that's true.
Do your own research.
Would you like to rank this first, buddy?
I will. So I do like this song. It ranks not as high as I think it's going to rank for you. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moving pieces to this, but this song has always been, we kind of nailed it in the first segment to where it's just, it feels like it's always been. So it doesn't have as, breaking it down the way we've done today has given it a much better ranking than what I was walking in with. I was going to give it low 70s.
Mm.
But now I think I'm going to drop in 79. It doesn't. Well, wait, I got to try to consider old songs we've done. I'll go 85. You know, I'm going to go 85 because that seemed to be kind of the Mendoza line.
Because we jumped a little bit, but I think Rolling Stone or Like a Rolling Stone, right? And was that 85? I think that was.
I don't know if we had a general consensus.
I think
I guess
that I did. Yours was probably different. I think it was in the 80s, though.
Yeah. This song deserves to be in the 80s. Here's the thing. This song comes on tomorrow. Skip.
Really?
Weird Al's, what is the title of it?
The Saga Begins, I think.
Yeah, The Saga Begins. Might not skip.
I don't
know what that says.
It's a no skip for either. If American Pie is on, and I guess we didn't mention this, but the song is 8.5 minutes long, and
it's a long tune.
I'm sticking around the whole time, and it feels like, no, it's like whenever I watch Braveheart, another piece of art made by a problematic person. If Braveheart is on, I'm sitting down and I'm watching that entire film. Like I've never watched a small piece of Braveheart. I'm gonna.
You know
watch
who else says that? This is a weird bit of information for me to know, but I've seen this in an interview with him. Charles Barkley, the same thing.
Good taste. Good minds.
Charles Barkley, good taste, huh?
Braveheart is a good movie.
It is. It's not a bad movie. And a little about me. I actually have direct ancestry to William Wallace.
Oh, my God. You have to make this about you.
And you know what's really sad? When I was a kid, I told so many people that I was related to Mel Gibson. Because I misinterpreted what my dad was telling me.
That is, and I imagine people hearing that going, your last name is McGregor, right? Are you sure? No, yeah. It's Mel Gibson.
And as we know from this podcast, I never misremember anything.
Of course you don't. You're beautiful baby boy.
85.
This is getting high for me. This is...
I was figuring it was going to be a really good rating for you.
This is a 98.
Yeah.
This is a 98. And it's better
than The Temptations, huh?
Don't make. It was The Temptations.
Well, for me, I gave him a really good.
Yeah, it was Temptations.
Better than Mother?
Yeah. We're getting into rarefied air with me.
Yeah, we're different people here.
Very rarefied air to where I could think of a couple songs that would get over the 98 hump. I don't know if there's a 100. I think we've had this conversation about discographies. Is there a 10 discography? I think there are stretches of discographies that are 10s, perhaps. But that's the beauty, right? It's like the ups and downs, the peaks and valleys. I don't know. And with a song, it's weird. Like we had that little mini series we did of like perfect songs. And and then we've gone on to say that no song is perfect. And I believe both. I do. I believe that there are songs that feel perfect and that they feel so kind of like perfectly constructed. Like it's just a song that relies often on like that simplicity and it's just the arrangement. Everything is just where it needs to be. It's not like you don't think you need to add or change anything.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, the imperfections of it that make it feel like in going to this song, it's how long it is. It's like a long epic film where like, the drags, the bumps, the like, there's something about that feels very lived in. Like I, as a piece, it's impossible, I guess, for me to deny.
Absolutely. And, you know, for as much as we've always said this again to anybody who's new to the podcast, rating a song is really for us to discuss aspects of the song. If I take out rating entirely, my final thought on this is I wouldn't change anything about this song. I don't think I would change
both
anything.
Take out the halftime line. Maybe? No.
Okay, yeah, you're right. I guess I would take out a couple verses.
Let's go back. Let's fix the song. You get the pen.
All right. A long, long time ago. I would follow
remember...
it. No. In a galaxy.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Great, great, great. Thank you for doing... I know that was a lot of work that I asked you to do, and I thank you for doing that.
Like I said, I got to listen to this song enough for the next... 5 years until I'm going to play it again.
I'll give you a quick inside look to Colton. I had to listen to this song one time before we recorded today.
I believe that.
So I was keeping it fresh.
I had heard this song so many times, but every moment I thought about doing this episode, I was like, fuck, listen to the song again.
Beautiful. So you have been thinking, well, no, you've decided since 2 weeks ago, I imagine, what song we're doing for our next song spotlight. Yeah. And I can even see now you're so certain you know what it is that you're just pausing for dramatic effect. And I'm talking for no reason. I'm not vamping for you.
Honestly, I have wanted to do an album by this artist for a while. Never knew which album. And so that's what gave me a lot of hesitancy. I went like, you know, this podcast is going to last forever. So we'll eventually get to an album from this artist. But
that's fair.
In you giving me a hint for this episode, you brought up the artist.
James Taylor?
No, that's fine.
Wait, Randy Newman?
No, you're thinking about the last episode.
I am.
Everybody, next. Yeah, episode. Well, we'll get into what we're listening to next episode.
Okay.
God, it's going to be tough for me to give hints here. I'll just start with summer.
Okay.
All right. So that's the first hint.
Okay. Summer.
My second hint is American Pie held a record that it no longer holds.
Is Taylor Swift? Is it a Taylor Swift song?
It is.
Is this for the bet? Are you doing this as a bet?
I'm doubling down because you're going to hate the Something New song more than you'll hate.
Wait, we need to qualify what this is. Have we talked about this yet on the pod?
Okay, so when Colton and I went to the Giants game.
I have a gambling problem, and I don't have a money gambling problem. I have a...
You should have had a money gambling problem, because I told Colton I think somebody's going to hit a home run.
Yeah.
And Colton had a very good, you know, you're talking about like, well, no, there's triple alley. The weather's not conducive to home runs. Mm-hmm, and I was like, well, I got a feeling. I'll bet you $5. And Colton's like, no, we're not going to do money for this.
Yeah.
What we'll do is you can choose a song that I hate or I choose a song you hate.
This
was not me trying to choose a song you hate.
This isn't?
No.
Okay.
I don't know how much you dislike or like Taylor Swift, but we've talked enough about her.
What's the song? I guess the song.
So what was my first hint?
Summer?
Summer. My second hint is Cruel.
Cruel Summer? Is that a song?
It is.
Maybe
a song,
I should also clarify, I don't know Taylor Swift songs. Because no Taylor Swift song is actually memorable.
I feel like this song is memorable, and I feel like it is her most popular song. I think that's what I was rolling with.
Cruel Summer? That's not her song.
No, I know what you're thinking. It's a cruel, cruel, cruel summer. That's,
yeah.
No, no, no. So this one has 3 billion listens.
Okay.
Almost 3.5 billion. Actually, rounded up, it's pretty much 3.5 billion.
I can very much so tell you this. I've never heard this song. I didn't even know this song.
I want to be surprised if you have.
I've never done this before. I'm going to very quickly play a little bit of this song for myself.
Sure. You've been in so many, like, clothing stores. There's no chance this song didn't randomly play in the background.
Okay, she's dancing on a beach. I hate it.
Let's save it, partner. I think the chorus hook is fantastic. See, this is all stuff that I don't even want to be. I wish I would have thought this out a little bit more, guys.
I've never heard this song.
Okay, perfect.
So we will do Cruel Summer by Taylor Swift. I've confirmed I have never heard this song.
Perfect, perfect. Basically, Max Muncy, not our Max Muncy, but a Max Muncy, hit a home run and made this begin, and you think you're not going to like this one.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. I just hope you're prepared for this, because if this is our next song spotlight, it's Taylor Swift's going to be tied to this podcast. If you thought that the Streetlight Manifesto fans were bad, our ratings Lifties, are going to take a hit. Our ratings, Lifties, we have a one-star review, and I know that's because of Streetlight. It has to, unless it's Casey Crescendo. It's a good deer hunter.
No, I think he's a bigger man. A bigger man than that. But Swifties, feel free. Come on in. We've already gone against the Beehive. We're coming for you.
We were pretty complimentary about.
I actually kind of like this song.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
I do.
Okay.
She writes her own songs. It's again me trying to do something. Me trying to do something a little different. This is the most popular one. I know this song, so. There we are.
Well, she's one of the 30 greatest American living songwriters. So yes. This will be a good composer.
Her musical compositions are not bad. Yeah.
Is the music playing yet? Can we go?
No, wait.